From the pulpit of the Capital City Baptist Church, we present Pulpit Echoes, a ministry of Pastor Adam Thompson and the Capital City Baptist Church. I'd invite you to stay with us because at the end of the broadcast, we'll give you our contact information. And now with a message from the Word of God, here's Pastor Adam Thompson.
Genesis chapter 37, we are considering the subject of manly men, a subject that our society doesn't care for. And as soon as you use those two words together, it makes people bristle a little bit. But we're looking at Joseph in this study, the life of Joseph, and the fact that he was God's man in Egypt, for Egypt. Now I want you to look at Genesis 37, verse 24. And they took him, Joseph, cast him into a pit. And the pit was empty, there was no water in it. They sat down to eat bread, and they lifted up their eyes and looked, and behold, a company of Ishmaelites came from Gilead with their camels bearing spicery and balm and myrrh, going to carry it down to Egypt. And Judah said to his brethren, "What profit is it if we slay our brother, conceal his blood? Come and let us sell him to the Ishmaelites. Let not our hand be upon him, for he is our brother and our flesh." And his brethren were content. Now go with me to Romans chapter 8, verse 28. You'll want to keep a finger there in Genesis 37 because we will be returning to this passage. Romans 8, 28 says, "And we know that all things work together for good to them that love God, to them who are called according to his purpose." I want to look this morning at the subject of the opportunity of adversity and then talk to you about the confusion found in Romans 8:28, the misunderstanding concerning the verse, how it applies to the life of Joseph. For a minute, although the life of Joseph is very familiar, let's consider once again those 13 years of adversity, because we know he had a dream, but after that, things quickly went downhill. We see as his brother, his 10 brothers, they hate him. We're talking about extreme hatred, cold hatred. To think about dislike, that's very understandable, but to consider the fact that they were so cold and calloused that they wanted to slay him, and they spoke about it so casually. Thankfully, one of the brothers stepped in and said, "Hey, let's not kill him. Let's sell him as a slave," as if that were merciful. And so he begins to live the life of a slave. You know the story where he excelled, how long he excelled, and how God was with him in and through all of that. But things quickly changed when Potiphar's wife began to tempt him. And when he resisted her advances, she falsely accused him. So now for doing right, he's thrown into prison. We know prison, no prison in this world is a place you desire to be. But if you go back thousands of years and consider the circumstances, those prisons, even less desirable. But through all of that, we find a young man not just surviving, but thriving. But here's what we've come to understand. Of course, great things can happen in bad times, and God uses tests and trials. Those are not cliches. That's Bible. We know that. We've lived that. We've understood that. But the real question is, how do we deal with pressure? And when we talk about trials, I'm not talking about normal circumstances of life, living on a sin-cursed earth. Because today's trials, if you mention that, the first thing that comes to mind, yeah, I had to deal with a delayed flight one time in an airport for 6 hours. That's really not what we're talking about this morning. I'm not talking about the inability to connect online. I'm not talking about a car that won't start or an extended cold or flu. We thank God that we live in a generation where there's medication now for everything. People used to die with a simple cold or flu centuries past. And thankfully in this day and age, you can replace a car battery for about $150. AutoZone, amen? Praise God for AutoZone. And even if you got delayed at the airport, you know that you can still jump on that flight sooner or later, 30,000 feet above the earth. And in a couple of hours, you can be thousands of miles away, you'll reach your destination. When in previous generations, if people traveled a few hundred miles, normally they were risking their lives to do it. So that little delay is not a real trial of faith. It's a simple frustration. And internet, you probably didn't need to get on it anyway. It's misspend the time. But if you didn't get on it, you will get on it soon. People for thousands of years lived without it and lived quite well. Yeah, Pastor, they had to live in a cave too. We're just thankful that those are what we call first world problems. If you go live in a foreign country, you realize real soon that people don't get frustrated over what we get frustrated over because they don't have our financial blessings. They don't take those things for granted. This week, my daughter managed to blow out two tires at one time. And while her car was sitting on the side of the highway, and I went to rescue her and be the good father, and wait for the tow truck, and then the wrong tow truck shows up, and then I wait another hour and a half for the next tow truck, and then I watch him as he literally starts to trash her vehicle, trying to get it up on the back of the tow truck because it sits so low. And after he scrapes off fenders and muffler, and I'm losing my patience with both her, him, and the rest of the world. I climbed in my car and realized, you know, there are people around the world that just wish they had a car. They wish they had a few $100 to replace blown out tires. So yeah, those are not trials, those are frustrations. And here's the reality of life. All of us have to deal with some adversity. And you know who we respect? Those moments as we look at others and how they deal with adversity that either builds our respect for them or destroys our respect for them. And as we look at Joseph and the heroes of the faith, we respect all of them, not because they avoided adversity, but because they dealt so well with adversity in the face of adversity. And here was Joseph. If you look at Joseph, there's no blight on his character. He was doing everything right, and everything was going wrong. Have you ever been there? You thought, I'm living according to the book, and everything is still going wrong. And God, in all of this and through all this, could have in an instant vindicated Joseph and righted the wrong, and he didn't. He just let it go on and on and on and on because he did have a plan, and he did have a purpose, and he had something he wanted to do in the life of Joseph. Now, here's what I want you to consider as we go through this message. I want you to mull over for just a moment Romans 8:28. Now, let's reread it. If you still have a finger there, let's reread it. It says, we know. This we know. This is one of the most familiar verses in all the Bible. We know that all things work together for good. How many of you in the midst of adversity, you quoted that verse and you said, I know, but I'm questioning. How is this all going to work out for good? Now we believe in the sovereignty of God. We know he has a purpose. But this is not a passive verse. And here's where we have mistaken this verse and misunderstood this verse. We know that all things work together for good because we forget to properly read the way it's written. We know that all things work together for good to them that love God, to them that are loving God, to them that continue to love God in the midst of their circumstance. You know why this was going to work out for Joseph? Because he loved God going in, he loved God going through, and he loved God going out. But you've also watched adversity in the life of people where it was destructive in nature, and it didn't all turn out so well, right? That was God's purpose. He's not going to help you avoid all the crises of life, but he says, in the midst of the crisis, I want to work and use this for good. But what if Joseph would have become bitter at some point in that crisis? What if Joseph would have lost the faith somewhere in that crisis? Although God meant it for good, and although God planned it for good, and although God has a way of taking evil and using it for good, it won't turn out for good simply because that's God's desire. So let's go back and take a look at Joseph here in Genesis. The opportunity of adversity, number one, it was the opportunity for Joseph to show himself Christ-like. Now, we have to remember this. We're in a lost world. They don't know anything about God this generation, even less than other previous generations. They don't have a Bible. They don't read this book. So their thoughts and their ideas concerning God and eternity are based on the only Bible they can read. That's you. So unless you've hidden the fact that you're a Christian, and many have, you shouldn't be a closet Christian. It's time to come out of the closet. Aaron and the brother in this generation is coming out of the closet. Time for Christians to come out of the closet. So I'm a Christian. I want everyone to know I'm a Christian. I'm a child of God. But in that, the world knows what a child of God's supposed to look like. So you're the only Bible that they're reading and going through this adversity. They're not there respecting your Christianity when you get your bonus and say, oh, look at him. He's got a smile on his face. He must be a Christian. All the world smiles when they get a bonus check. They're not looking at you and saying how Christ-like, his marriage is going well, and he seems to be pretty happy with his wife and with his children. No, they're observing you in the midst of the crisis, and they're waiting to see something that is Christ-like in its action or reaction. And so as we face adversity, others are watching, and maybe the spouse, it may be the children, it may be the family, or it may be the co-workers, but someone is observing your life and waiting to see if you're a fair weather Christian or if what you have is real and good enough for the crisis. How many believe that Christianity is good enough for the crisis? If Christianity wasn't made for the crisis, it's no good at all. And here's Joseph. And we know it would take several sermons just to go through Joseph and the similarities and the parallels. I don't believe there's anyone in the Bible that is a better parallel of Christ than Joseph. We can mention these things. Joseph was hated by his brethren. He was sold into the hands of his enemies. He was sold by one close to him named Judah. Number 15 on my list. We'll just skip several more. He was sold for the price of a slave. He became a servant. He prospered as a servant. He was tempted, yet he sinned not. Do you see the parallels between Joseph and Christ? He was falsely accused. He was punished, although he was innocent. He was quiet before his accusers. He was numbered among the transgressors. Now, the list goes on and on, but here's what we see in the life of Joseph. A man that, in the face of crisis, instead of stepping down, he stepped up. Instead of acting in ways that were unseemly, he acted in ways that were very Christ-like. So when we get to a moment of crisis as men, we have the opportunity to say, because I have Christ in me and the Holy Spirit working in me, this is a tremendous opportunity to parallel the life of Christ. And while others are watching, while my family is watching, while my friends are watching, while my coworkers are watching, I want them to see Christ in me. I don't want this adversity to be an opportunity to act or react in a way that would hurt or harm the name and the honor and the glory of the Lord Jesus Christ. Have you ever had one of those moments in the middle of crisis where you just said what you were thinking and later on you said, boy, that wasn't good. Can't believe that came out of my mouth. I thank God for examples. Many you have seen in the church dealing with crises, dealing with cancer, dealing with problems. We've had preachers come through. The list is endless. Brother Tom Williams, one of the more famous men that has suffered through crises, and a wife with extreme illness that he took care of as if she were his own little child for years, for decades before her passing. Brother Rick Dawson, Brother John Bishop, and others that have dealt with extreme crisis, and we've seen them, and there are no men on the planet that we'd consider more Christ-like, because in the middle of the adversity, they decided, they asked themselves, how would Christ act in this crisis, and I want to act like him. I want to live like him. It's a great opportunity. Number two, it's an opportunity to step up. The adversity that we face in life is an opportunity to step up and stand out. Now, too often in life, people when challenged, they step down or they step out in the sense of just stepping totally out of church and out of Christianity. We're talking about standing out, not stepping out. And this started in his youth. Look what it says, verse 2. There he is, surrounded by 10 brothers. He's 17 years old. He's feeding the flock with his brethren. And look what it says at the end of the verse. Joseph brought unto his father their evil report. Now, I've heard people mispreach this, misrepresent this. He came back as his dad. His dad knew these boys were not a good crowd. Said, Joseph, all I need to know is what's going on. Did you know that simply by doing the right thing, you're going to stand out? It doesn't matter if it's at your job, doesn't matter if you're at school or at college, wherever you go, young people. If you just do the right thing, you're going to look awkward, feel awkward, and stand out because most people are not doing the right thing. If you stand up against evil, and I'm not talking about making a scene, simply backing up and saying, I don't want to participate in that. I don't want to go that way. I don't want to do that. You're going to look different. And it's not, he didn't look different or stand out simply because he had a coat of many colors, although that was part of it. I mean, if you have a coat that's really colorful, you've seen people occasionally wear something like that. Makes you stand out. He wore it all the time. Now, this had to be awkward. Trust me, if you think Joseph was proudly walking around with this coat, sharing it, showing it, you don't know 17-year-olds. You know what a 17-year-old guy wants? He's not looking for some colorful coat. He's looking to blend, not stick out. Now, here's what happens. If you've been born again, you're a child of God, you're favored by the Father, I don't care where you go, you're going to stick out. How many realize you just got Jesus and that's it? Your countenance is different. Your attitude is different. Your perspective is different. Your speech is different. It's like you're walking around with this really colorful coat and you don't know how to hide it. Just being a Christian makes you distinct. God states it this way in the book of Peter. You're a peculiar people. Don't always like that, but that's the way life is. And we ought to say, in the midst of this adversity, here's what I'm going to do. I'm going to step up. And yes, this means I'm going to stand out. Wherever Joseph went, he steps up out of that pit. He was sold because he didn't come out of that. I don't believe for a second Joseph came out of that pit moaning and groaning and eyes bulging from crying crocodile tears. And I think when that company came by and they were offered this young man, they with great joy pulled out those coins and bought him as a slave, saying, we just got us a bargain. There he is. Look what it says in chapter 39. Standing up, stepping up, standing out. Joseph was brought down to Egypt. Potiphar, the officer of Pharaoh's captain of the guard, bought him. Look what it says, verse 2. The Lord was with Joseph, and he was a prosperous man, and he was in the house of his master, the Egyptian, and his master saw that the Lord was with him and that the Lord made all that he did to prosper in his hand. And Joseph found grace in his sight, and he served him. He made him overseer over his house, and all that he had he put into his hand. We see this, that Joseph keeps stepping up. So instead of wallowing in this pit of self-depression like so many do, he steps up. When you are in a crisis, if you get desperate for God, here's what I've seen. I've heard people pray in a crisis, and here's how some, God, you know, I'd certainly like for you to get involved in this. God understands the voice of desperation. Let me just be honest with you. We all know when someone else speaks to us how desperate they are for our presence or how much they want us to accompany them. Have you ever asked, do you want me to go with you? You ever asked your kids that? You want me to go with you? I've asked my two now that they're getting older. You know, they're going out Sunday night after church, get with the friend. I'm like, hey, you want me to go with you? Oh, yeah, Dad, if you want to come, if you don't have anything to do, if all your talks are over and you have no appointments, okay, I'm getting the idea. You don't want me to be there. I'm fine. And did you want at least some of my money? They're happy to take that. I just know at that point. Now, there are other times, like the phone call I received this Friday about the blown out tires. Ashley was very happy to have me present. She was very happy to have me take her to the tire shop and take care of her business. That brought great joy to her soul because it was crisis. And guess what? In the midst of the crisis, God knows how intent we are in getting him involved in the crisis. You know why I believe God was so present in the midst of this crisis? Because Joseph was desperately in need, saying, God, I'm here, this is a tough spot, and I need you working in me and through me and for me and doing something special on my behalf. Too many Christians have got it all figured out, even the crisis. You know, I got a bank account. I think I can make this all happen. I've got insurance that'll take care of most of this. And I've got a good mind, and I'm 50 years old, and I'm fully experienced. And God says, okay, help yourself. I'll just stand back and watch. But that was not Joseph's case. And he's doing right. He's so determined to do right. We'll probably speak on the subject this evening of his integrity. But even after the temptation, even after resisting the temptation, being falsely accused, being thrown in the prison, his perspective, his philosophy, his attitude, his spirit, his desire, nothing changes. Now, here's what I need you to consider. We know that all things work together for good. Consider this for a moment. What if he comes out of the pit, he's sold as a slave, and he says, you know what, I was doing the right thing. I was living the right life. I wanted God to use me. None of that worked out. So guess what? I'm in Egypt. I might as well become an Egyptian. My parents aren't going to know. It doesn't matter. I tried the right path. That didn't work out very well. So guess what? If Potiphar's wife is offering herself, and I'm here, and God hasn't intervened, and nothing has changed, what's the big deal? But here's the problem with all things working out. All things work out for them that are loving God and don't stop loving God because of the crisis. There's no end in between the two phrases, for those that love God and are called. I've heard people quote the verse, and that's normally how they quote it. They throw an and in there. Those are not two separate things. Those that love God are called to fulfill his purpose. And when you understand, I'm put on this planet to fulfill his purpose. Wherever he put me, whatever he has planned, that's exactly what I'm going to do. I'm going to love him and continue to love him. And God says, if you can maintain that philosophy, all things will work out for good. But we get in the crisis and say, well, it doesn't matter what I do because it's all going to work out for good anyways. No, you misrepresent it. God's holy word. You're going to have to be in the crisis and say, the crisis doesn't change anything. The crisis doesn't change my faith. The crisis doesn't change my love. The crisis doesn't change my responsibility. The crisis doesn't change my duty. The crisis doesn't change my perspective. The crisis doesn't change my faithfulness to God. Because I want this to work out for good. This is a team effort. You're not a Calvinist. You shouldn't be a Calvinist. It's not going to work out very well if you're a Calvinist to say, you know what, no matter what I do, it's all going to work out for good. Yeah, we've watched people. That didn't work out so much for good. That's why people have lost the faith, because they said, look at that crisis, and look at him, and look at his destination. Look. Because you misrepresented God's word. We know that all things work out for good to them, for them that love the Lord. To them that are called and they understand they're supposed to live according to his purpose, even in the midst of the crisis. You know why? For Brother Tom Williams, it's worked out for the good, because in the midst of the crisis, he didn't go back, he didn't stop, he didn't quit, he didn't turn on God, he didn't lose the faith. Right. And as a result, how many have been saved just through the film that was made about his life story and the story of his wife? I'm not talking about thousands, we're talking about hundreds of thousands. So yes, we can say we know that that worked out for good, because in the crisis, he kept loving God and living to fulfill the purpose of God in his life. And that's Joseph. He said, I'm going to step up. A few verses later in Romans 8, it says, go back there with me for just a moment, verse 35, it talks about, shall anything separate us from the love of Christ? Tribulation, distress, persecution, famine, nakedness, sword. And here's the answer, verse 37. Nay, in all these things we are what? We're what? We're not just a conqueror. We're more. In the midst of famine? In the midst of nakedness, we're conquerors. In the midst of persecution? In the midst of tribulation? In the midst of sword? I've never found myself in any of these conditions. I've never faced real tribulation, real persecution, real famine, real peril, real sword. I don't think I could say that in my entire life I faced any of those things. But Paul says in the midst of that, we are more than conquerors through him that loved us. And if we're not saying in the midst of this crisis, this is the opportunity to stay faithful and to stand up and to refuse to allow ourselves to become a slave. Here's what Joseph did not do in this circumstance. He did not allow himself to become a slave to his circumstance. I'm going to rise above that. Recently, several months ago, I preached on a nation of victims. And I have no intention of re-preaching that this morning. But if there's any chair in this nation that's being fought over, it's the same chair of victimization. I don't care where you go. I'm a victim. Colleges are about everyone fighting over who's the biggest victim. Whites are the victim. Hispanics are the victim. Blacks are the victim. Muslims are the victim. Women are the victim. White male men are the victim. Black males are the victim. Teens are the victim. No. Wives say, I'm the victim. Husbands say, no, I'm the victim. And they're fighting over the same chair. Give me that. That's my chair. I'm the biggest victim. In this world, there's no bigger badge of honor than to be able to proclaim, I have been victimized. We're in a different generation because the previous generation went through world wars and suffered real tragedies and real hardships and real suffering. None of them ever wanted to be known as a victim or ever claimed to be a victim. But this generation loves to pull out the violin and tell you. I mean, they'll talk to you about things they can't even remember because a psychologist has pulled it out. The deep, dark recesses of their mind, what you suffered when you were 2 and 3 and 6 and 10 and 12. Yeah. And everybody in your life made you a victim. I don't even know how you survived life in America. All the problems, all the things that made you a victim. Here's what happens in life. This life will give you an excuse to act like a victim. And Joseph never sat in this chair. When he was in the pit, he didn't pull up this chair. When he was in prison, he didn't pull up this chair. When he was falsely accused, he didn't pull up this chair. He said, I'm not going to live that way. I'm not going to act that way. Because I know that before the verse was ever written, I know that God has a plan in this and he can make this all good. Number 3, adversity is opportunity to strengthen your character. To help you grow tougher. You know this as parents. You know what you do as a parent? You allow your children to deal with certain aspects of adversity to make them tougher. And when you notice a weakness in the life of one of your children, you don't overwhelm them with adversity, but you allow them a little bit of adversity to strengthen them. We have a weak generation, a pampered generation. Physically, spiritually, emotionally, because parents who've babied their children, well, God knows better than to raise spoiled brats. So he allows a little bit of adversity to help us toughen up. God has a process. He wants us to take us through the process to toughen us up. You guys all have heard of Charles Lindbergh and the spirit of St. Louis and how he crossed the Atlantic. And I remember reading about that as a kid. When you have no fuel gauges. When you know those that have previously attempted to make it across, landed in the ocean, they were never found again. I don't think that I would be the one in that plane saying, hey, let's make it happen. You have to have some inner fortitude, some inner strength. And he certainly did. He lands in Paris, the hero's welcome. But to me, the hero of that story is not Charles Lindbergh. If you read about Charles Lindbergh, you'll read about his grandpa, Mr. August Lindbergh, that immigrated from Sweden. And when he came over, he came to work at a sawmill. And there in that sawmill, he'd only been working there a couple of years. He took one of those saws and accidentally put it through his torso. And we're talking about a century ago. And they carried him home. They carried him home half alive. They put him in a bed. The doctor doesn't even show up. How they kept him alive for 2 or 3 days till the doctor showed up, I don't know. So he shows up, amputates his arm, sews him back together. Now that's a man. Now you know the most astounding part of the story is? Those that witnessed it said He never screamed. He never yelled. He never cried. He never whimpered. He never even said, ouch. No wonder he had a grandson that got in a plane and said, hey, let's cross the Atlantic here. When you got a grandpa that's a man so tough that he can put a saw through his body, deal with an amputation, and never shed a tear, that's manly manhood. That's a different level. Now, when my dad used to say, son, I don't care if they knock your head off, you find some duct tape and you put it back on, he was speaking metaphorically. Because I doubt if my head would have been detached from my body, he would have literally told me, here's the duct tape. I don't want to hear a whimper. All of your dads use some of that terminology because they were old school. But this guy didn't just use the terminology, he lived it. And you know what? We have a generation now that cries at the drop of a hat, and they drop their own hat. Everything is a crisis. Everything is a trial. This is a generation that doesn't know how to recover. Number four, adversity is an opportunity to shine in your faith. Go back with me to chapter 40. Look what it says in verse 8. So here is he's facing a prison sentence for doing right. He finds favor. Look what it says, verse 23. The keeper of the prison looked not to anything that was under his hand, because the Lord was with him, with Joseph. And that which he did, Joseph did, the Lord made it to prosper. But look what it says, verse 8. They said to him, we have dreamed a dream. Now, he's in prison. He has two fellow inmates that have dreamed a dream, and they're asking him for some help. And they said, there's no interpreter for our dreams. And Joseph said to them, do not interpretations belong to God? Let me ask you this. If you're 7, 8 years into a trial and you've done right and things continue to spiral downhill and go out of control, are you still going to be speaking positively about God? You guys are in a crisis. I know you have a problem, but God has a solution. Look what it says in chapter 41, verse 16. So Joseph's brought up out of the prison by Pharaoh. And Joseph answered Pharaoh, saying, it is not in me. God shall give Pharaoh an answer. So what do you do when nothing makes sense? Here's what Joseph did. He kept the faith. He's not demanding to understand. He's accepting God's sovereignty. And I'm convinced that God wants to see what we're going to do and how we're going to respond when nothing makes sense and when the situation is all backwards and inside out and upside down. Now, here's what I want you to see. Go with me to chapter 50, verse 20. Here's Joseph at the end. He's looking back. He's talking to his brethren because they're fearful. They're fearful. Jacob is dead, and they think, well, as long as Dad's alive, Joseph's not going to retaliate. But Joseph never had it in his heart. We're going to see this, that what carried Joseph through this crisis was there was no bitterness. He was able to quickly forget. He was able to quickly recover. He was quickly able to overcome. But when we talk about the crises, we often overestimate our faith. So we consider ourselves, we're people of faith. We have strong faith. Well, the crisis is going to reveal that. And here's the opportunity of adversity, is to say that faith that I think I have, that faith that supposedly has grown over the years, now that I'm in the midst of the crisis, now we get to see. Do I have faith? Or is my faith shot? Do I believe in God, or am I struggling? And I'm convinced that he's sovereign, he's the ruler, he has a purpose. He can use this for good, he can turn evil. It's not that God plans evil, it's that no matter what happens in an evil world, God can take the evil. You know this. In your background, there's some things that you suffered. There's some evil that you suffered. There's some problems that you dealt with. And you look back and say, those were wasted years. That was a mess. That was a disaster. And then somehow later in life, God uses that, which you experienced. Not good, but sin, but evil, but wrongdoing, but based on the hurt and the evil intentions of someone else. God did not intend that for to happen, but God says, you living on a sin-cursed earth, I can take that evil that was meant for bad and turn it in your favor and use it for good. So here's what he says to his brethren. He says, you thought evil, verse 20, ye thought evil against me. That's exactly what we see back in chapter 37, right? They're casually sitting around saying, let's kill him. Let's end his life. Let's end our problem. Get rid of this kid. Last moment, they decide to sell him. But they're cold. They're calloused. You thought evil against me. But God meant it unto good to bring to pass, as it is this day, to save much people alive. So he said, although your intentions were evil, God meant it. Now hold on for a second. What's the exact wording here? God meant. That means God's intention is whatever evil happens to you, it can be used for good. God doesn't plan evil for you. Evil happens because of the planet we live on. But God says, whatever evil you've suffered, whatever hurt you've endured, whatever problem you're dealing with, whatever tragedy has taken place in your life, God says, I mean that to be used for good. The problem is, God's intention doesn't always come to pass. Why? Because we can't take us out of the equation. So God says, I can use all of this for my glory, for my good. It will help you. I want to strengthen you. I want you to step up. I want you to show your faith. But in the midst of the crisis, we know. We're assured of that. We know that all things, everything, no matter what it is, evil or good, all things, what? Work together for good. What's the condition? How do we know that they'll work together for good? To them that love God and say, I'm going to keep loving God. I'm not going to quit loving God. Through this crisis, I'm going to love God. I'm called according to his purpose. I'm going to fulfill that purpose in the midst of the crisis so it works out for good. Because if you get in the middle of the crisis and you start stumbling and bumbling around, I don't know if I can deal with this. I don't know if I can manage this. I don't know if I want this. I don't understand what God's doing. It's amazing the questions we ask in the midst of crisis. It's amazing that our spirituality is so low that the parking lot can create a crisis. Hey, for those of you that are visiting this morning, you saw these people in suits and ties with a hymn book, and they're standing up singing, blessed be the name, blessed be the name. Watch out. When they pull in the parking lot, if you take their parking spot, they will cut you. That person that looks so spiritual, yeah, I wouldn't test his Christianity in the parking lot. You know the real test of Christianity? Go check in between those lines about 10 till 10. Some of you aren't laughing because you're carrying a switchblade just waiting to knife someone's tires because they took your spot. That's not the crisis that I'm talking about. If your Christianity can't take the parking lot crisis, what's it going to do in the midst of a real crisis? I'm not talking about your faith in good economic times and you can say, oh, I believe God can provide for me. Yeah, because you just got a raise, you just got a bonus, and you've invested well, and you just saw your investment shoot up about 20%. Oh, yeah, God's good. Yeah. Yeah, come talk to me when they lay you off and the stock market drops and your company doesn't provide for you a Christmas bonus, and they take away your truck and your gas allowance. Then come back and tell me about your great faith. Then come back and quote to me, and we know that all things. We're in Argentina. I'll finish with this. And Ashley is having her first surgery. She's 6 months old. I mean, she is just, okay, this girl was born tiny. But because of her heart problem, she didn't grow that much. She didn't put on that much weight. So they open her up. They send her home. Poorly sewed up, but she immediately gets a chest infection. So we're looking at her, listening to her wheeze and cough, and we're saying she's obviously inflamed in the incision. So we don't have a vehicle. We get an ambulance out there. We're an hour away from the hospital. I load up my wife and and they go back into Cordoba and had 10 days dealing with the hospital and ICU, and we're talking about a very low point in our lives. We have a little boy, and we're trying to figure out how to get back and forth and take care of this baby, and this was back before internet, cell phone, Facebook. This is not that long ago. Some of you, the young people, are looking at me, before Facebook? Who lived before Facebook? We're not communicating with my parents. My parents aren't down there. Her mother's not down there. It's us in a bus and a baby that's in bad shape. And we have brand new Christians. You know, they're a year old in the Lord. And I have a guy that recently saved. He comes up to the hospital to visit us. Smells like smoke, puts his cigarette up. And then he looked over and said, you know, Pastor, what Romans 8:28 says. I want to take that smoke and jam it up his nostril. I don't want to be in the hospital and hear you quote to me Romans 8:28 with a cigarette on your mouth. But there he is saying, you know, all things work together for the good. The only problem is there's a misquotation there. Because in his mind, doesn't matter what happens or what you do or how you feel or how you live, it's all going to work out magically and for the good. Well, there's several misnomers here. Number one, God did not say it always worked out for your good. That's where we get angry and bitter at God. It'll work out for good. It just may not be specifically for your good. God says, I can take this evil and make good out of it. And he said, it works out for good for those that love God even in the crisis. And you've got to get it in your mind. God never needs help, but you need help. And God is sovereign. But you better say, I'm going to make sure this turns out for good. So in the crisis, I'm going to put on my big boy pants. And I'm going to say, I want some good to come out of this. And I want some people to be helped. And I want some souls to be saved. And I want God to be honored. And I want God to be glorified. So I'm not going to quit. I'm not going to lay down. I'm not going to play the victim. I'm not going to stop serving. I'm not going to give up on God. Because I know God is capable of turning this out for good. But he puts a condition on that promise. We know. We have confidence. All things. They work together for good. What's the condition? To them that love God. To those that are called according to his purpose and live that way.
The Capital City Baptist Church is located at 1300 Red Street in beautiful Austin, Texas. We'd invite you to join us if you're in town. 10 a.m. Sunday mornings, 6 p.m. Sunday night, and 7:30 each and every Wednesday evening. Our phone number is 512-447-9454, but I'd like to point your attention specifically to our website, capitalcitybaptist.org. There you'll find information regarding service times, the staff, and all about Capital City Baptist Church. Additionally, you can find an archive of previously preached messages there for you to download, enjoy, and pass on to friends and family. Again, that website is capitalcitybaptist.org. That's capital with an O, citybaptist.org. Be sure and tell a friend and do your best to join us again for Pulpit Echoes, a ministry of the Capital City Baptist Church.